Political career goes back to college when she was elected president of Hunter College. She applied to Harvard Law School, where she was rejected with a letter explaining that they didn't accept women. She went to Columbia Law School instead, where she received a scholarship. Ebzug was a founding member of Women's Strike for Peace, where she served as national political director for 10 years. In 1970, she was elected to Congress. Her slogan was, "This woman's place is in the House of Representatives." She was a co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus. After 3 terms in Congress, in 1976, Ebzug became the first woman from New York to run for the United States Senate. Daniel Moynihan defeated her by a margin of less than 1%. In 1977, she ran for New York mayor and was defeated by Ed Koch. That same year, President Carter named her presiding officer of the National Commission for the Observance of International Women's Year, which sponsored the National Women's Conference in Houston, Texas. Carter also appointed her co-chair of the National Advisory Committee for Women. She was fired in January of 1979 after the committee criticized his decision to cut funding for women's programs while increasing military spending. Bella Ebzug is currently the president of Women USA, a national organizing group she founded, which is running a campaign to register more women and to get out the women's vote. Bella Ebzug has written a new book. It's titled Gender Gap, Bella Ebzug's Guide to Political Power for American Women. Gender Gap is published in paper by Houghton Mifflin. You can hear her speak this evening at the University of Pennsylvania. It is open to the public. Her address will be held in Logan Hall, room 17 at 7:30. Logan Hall is at 36th and Spruce Streets. For more information, you can call 898-8740. That's 898-8740. Bella Ebzug, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello.
I think a lot of independent, successful women didn't become feminists of your generation because they felt, well, they were able to do it. What's the big problem? Why couldn't other women do it too? Have you given any thought to why you did become a feminist?
Well, I've often been asked that question. I think I've been an instinctive feminist almost all of my life. It's very difficult for me to understand that women did not become feminists, although I have met many professional women of my era who were feminists. Some of the early supporters of equal rights in the Republican Party, or business and professional women, for example, were feminists. I can remember ever since I was a little kid wanting to do things that were not available to me. And then little by little I did them and I found out that you could do them. So I think I was instinctively pressing for that right all my life. Having sort of consciously wanted to do certain things, like you mentioned that I went to law school, I wanted to be a lawyer ever since I was 11 years old, which was a sort of a strange decision for a young girl in those days. I don't know the reason. I often say it's probably because there was a fierce sense of social justice in my home. And somehow or other, I thought if I could be a lawyer that I could set things right. I mean, I described it in my book, Gender Gap, an incident, which is sort of interesting because it was similar to an incident portrayed in the movie Yentl, if you saw it. When I was growing up and fairly young, my father died, and we had no boys in the family. In an odd Jewish tradition, only a boy says memorial prayers every day for a deceased parent. I saw no reason why I shouldn't, and so I went to the synagogue and did that. People were sort of shocked by it, but they didn't stop me. So, I mean, there's something like that portrayed in the story of Yentl that Barbara Streisand is in. And I think that also is an indication of some notion that that I had always sort of felt what was human and available should be human and available regardless. And that when I proceeded to do it, I was able to do it. I mean, I was very outraged. I always had a decent sense of outrage when I was rejected at Harvard. But it didn't stop me. I went, you know, there were very few women lawyers at that time, 3% of us. I went on to become a lawyer, and I practiced law every day, and it was kind of a rough road. I mean, people were kind of unaccustomed to women lawyers, and lots of experiences many women can share with you. I'm out of law school 40 years, almost 40 years, 39 probably. Well, when I was, for example, I was married while I was in law school. So, I mean, when I went to court pregnant, as I did, I practiced every day of my life till the day I decided to run for Congress. Everybody was terrified. My clients thought I would lose the case. The judges were uncomfortable, and the lawyers were unaccommodating on the other side. So there were lots of experiences that one had in the kind of work that I did that would certainly lead one to wanting to make sure that there were a greater receptivity of the potential participation of women on all levels. It's as simple as that. I can't explain it, except that I understood that this had to be changed. I mean, I went through certain fire and testing, as other women did, but some people tend to resolve things inwardly for oneself. Others tend to relate to the social concerns as a whole, and I was always a very socially conscious human being ever since I was a young student. So, naturally my approach would be to try to change it with others, not just for myself.
While you were practicing law, you also were a co-founder of Women's Strike for Peace, and you were the political director for 10 years. But then after that, you decided...
That was my contribution to what I thought was essential in the peace movement. I felt that the Women's Strike for Peace was a great movement. I was one of the founders, but I felt that it had to be more clearly directed legislatively and politically to try to influence the power structure to change its policies on disarmament and fight for general and complete disarmament by agreement, of course, mutual. And also during the Vietnam War, that it was important to influence the Congress on the whole question of the nuclear arms race and Vietnam War, and that had to be organized other than an emotional response to the fact that the United States and Soviet Union had resumed nuclear testing in the atmosphere, which created radioactive fallout in strontium 90, which affected the milk of our children. So I felt we had to go beyond just our emotional dismay, which is what we did initially, and try to help that movement become much more organized in legislative pressure terms and political terms of influencing the power structure to change. So I felt that was why I did that kind of work.
What did you want a women's group? Did you think that women could bring a different kind of pressure to Congress?
Let me give you an idea. During the time that I was active as a legislative and political action director, as a volunteer, obviously. I practiced law full-time. The Russia and the United States resumed nuclear testing. There was pressure for an atmospheric nuclear test ban, testing. And it was passed. It was a partial test ban treaty banning atmospheric tests under John Kennedy's regime. Women's Strike for Peace had a great deal to do with that. So we had to lobby senators and legislators and so on. At that time, it was amazing that it was passed, and many people said it was the mother's vote that the senators were afraid of. Women were very active in that, and they showed that they could muster up a lot of support. There were thousands of women that would demonstrate and come to Washington to show their deep concern, and the senators reacted. And many said it was the mother's vote, just like we are now talking today about the women's vote, which encompasses nurturers and people themselves who are not nurturers but who are women, who have a different socialization, a different acculturation, and have always felt very strongly about certain issues in society, especially the issue of war and peace.
Bella Abzug is my guest, and her new book is titled The Gender Gap. You decided to go politically from being a prominent member of a political action group to being a politician, to running for the House. What did you want to stop practicing law to be in politics? Did you have a lot of faith at that time in the political process for increasing women's equality?
Well, look, I had been an activist all of my life. I came from the movements of social change. I was an activist as a student. I was an activist as a lawyer. I participated very strongly in the concerns of people whose liberties were attacked. I was an active civil rights lawyer and civil liberties lawyer during the McCarthy period, representing people whose liberties were under attack. I was involved in civil rights in the South and the North in cases involving the right of Negroes to be on juries and some very famous cases, and also worked on many legislative questions of those varieties. I was, as you now described, active in the peace movement, and I came to the conclusion and tried always to influence the political power structure for change, which is the way most change comes about in the history of American politics. It's from the grassroots public pressure of opinion that the movements take place in on the legislative or public policy level. It doesn't happen too much from within. There's not a great deal of desire on the part of those in power to move unless they're pressed to move in directions. So I felt that I was making a contribution most of my life in trying to do that. At the height of the Vietnam War and also at the beginnings of the Born Again Women's Movement, of which I was a part, clearly, there was much concern on my part that after many, many years of working very constructively with the Democratic Party, with other groups, to try to influence politicians and political parties and their platforms to move decisively on the questions of disarmament, on the civil rights, on economic questions, and especially on the war in Vietnam, I was quite dismayed that not much was happening. We were going deeper into the war in Vietnam, and so I was always asked by many people to run for public office. It was never a thing on my agenda. I'd never really thought about it. I'd always helped to elect other people, spent lots of time fashioning programs, platforms for other candidates on the national level, presidential candidates, gubernatorial, mayoral candidates, congressional candidates, and helped to mobilize a lot of women into that political effort through Women's Strike for Peace and other places and through also mobilizing other groups through various committees which I had formed for that purpose. And when after one election, I described this in the book, I had this serious conversation with the mayor of the city of New York, who was at that time Mr. Lindsay, and I was complaining about the fact that I had helped to put together these organizations, which had hoped for certain kinds of response to community groups and didn't see it. And he said, you know, Bella, you're always complaining. Why don't you do it yourself? And I said, that's a great idea. I think I will. And that was the first time I decided to do something. I went away for a week and went scuba diving and down there in the depths with nothing but the sound of the depths and beauty, I made that decision to run. I came to the conclusion that it was time that an activist came into the power structure. I think that activists in the power structure come in with a lot more independence than as women generally do, by the way. Women generally come in independently, not from the boardrooms and back rooms, but from the communities of concern. And I thought it was time. That was why, for example, was my slogan, which, you know, you see on T-shirts, we introduced for the first time in my campaign, which was, this woman's place is in the House of Representatives. And when I was elected election night, my older daughter said, thank God we got her out of our house into their house. But, you know, the point is that I was trying to make a point. And I think I did.
Did you feel it was necessary to tone down your politics at all, because sometimes activists can be more radical as an independent group than they can when they're trying to win a majority
vote? Well, I obviously didn't. I mean, one of the reasons I never ran is that I felt that I was established a very independent stance on most issues and that I was not prepared to give them up. And I always hesitated running for public office. It had been proposed to me previously because of that. But in fact, I didn't. I came to Congress in order to accomplish something. I mean, I came to Congress after having had a pretty full career as a lawyer and a mother and a wife and a citizen and an activist for a lot of years. And so I wasn't really just starting out in my career life. I was changing it entirely in order to accomplish something. And my platform was based upon not only an end to the war in Vietnam, a change of urban priorities, which were very crucial since I came from New York City, as well as a women's rights platform, which is probably one of the rare times at that stage that a woman ran specifically on a woman rights platform. And it was, you know, therefore I came to Congress as an activist and never really changed that. I was an active legislator, and everybody knows, at least some people know, that I was very active as a legislator, having accomplished a lot of legislation in the field of economic development, public works, jobs programs, and so on, bringing $6 billion into New York State, and was active in trying to end the war in Vietnam, and the first to call for Mr. Nixon's impeachment, and chaired a committee on government information and individual rights, where we investigated during the Watergate period the CIA, the FBI, and then resulted in a lot of legislation that I either co-authored or authored, the Sunshine Law and Privacy Act and the amendments to the Freedom of Information Act, and a lot of women's rights and women new kinds of ideas for women's legislation. But the fact is that I never lost my activism. I always remained active with the women's movement, with the peace movement, civil rights movement, all the things that I cared about. So I combined both. I think both are essential. I think you need movements for pressure for change on the outside. I think you need strong people and good voices that are very independent on the inside.
Bella Abzug is my guest, and her new book is called The Gender Gap. Were the women in the House at that time organized around women's issues together?
We had an informal caucus in which we tried to get women to move together on crucial issues affecting women, and we did a lot of good work. We strengthened, after we passed the equal credit law, we had some problems with the regulations, and we moved together to prevent any weakening. And on issues like child care, Shirley Chisholm and I were very involved in an initial child care bill, which, by the way, Walter Mondale was very actively involved in sponsoring as a senator, which was the only one that was really passed of any comprehensive nature, which was ultimately vetoed by Mr. Nixon. And we came together on issues affecting abortion, equal rights, and so on. We were a loose group so that we didn't have to, a rigid problem of votes. You know, if we could, whoever came together. After a while, they put one together which had some other problems because they needed a certain amount of consensus. And now there's a very fine women's caucus functioning, which is more formal, which has also membership among some of the men in the Congress. And I think they've been doing a very effective job. Actually, the interesting thing about it is that women voted very well across party lines, Republican and Democratic, on a lot of issues affecting women, also social programs, as well as having a much more liberal attitude towards the military and wanting to see much more cuts in it. And that's also fully described in detail in the in our book, obviously, and describing why women make a difference. Will women change power, or will power change women? I believe women will change power.
The period that we're talking about now is the early 70s. Were the men in Congress at that time educated on women's issues, if you use the word feminism or...
What
did you do to...
There were men who understood the importance of equal rights. I mean, there's some outstanding people. Don Edwards of the Judiciary Committee, who to this day has carried an enormous struggle in behalf of the Equal Rights Amendment. There were quite a few men who understood the differences, that there had been dramatic changes in the lives of women and that they were not reflected in public policy. And that they were not reflected in any kind of institutional change or even the legislative process, because most laws have been written a long time ago. I mean, you know, like a Social Security law was written 50 years ago. It didn't contemplate women working to the degree that they do, or that it would be impossible in a high cost of living era, which we've been in now for many, many years, for people to survive on the pittance of Social Security that a lot of homemakers get. So, most laws didn't contemplate anything. Child care, for example. We still don't have any since Nixon vetoed that first bill that we worked on. Have any meaningful comprehensive. We have some, obviously. There was no real concept of the need for flexible hours, for the need for laws against domestic violence and on a federal level, the need for child enforcement payments, enforcement of child payments, child support payments, or the fact that the tax laws and the Social Security laws really discriminated against women and had to be changed. So it's been a long process of education. I don't think it's still fully understood by many. I think you will get philosophic agreement. You will get substantive agreement. But nobody in the Congress, most men don't lose any sleep over not getting a piece of legislation passed to help women break the cycle of poverty, by having job training or child care, or by having an equal rights amendment, or by having a right a right to abortion. I think that there are lots of programs and policies that the men support, as in fact the country shows. Men outside of legislative bodies support a majority of them, the legal inequitable issues that women strive for. But they're not. That's not their priority. And that's why it's important to have more women in office. Because when the women come to Congress, whether they're feminists to start with or not, they come to understand, as many of them will tell you, both Republican and Democrat, that they never realized how exclusionary the law is about women's present lives and how it's important for them not only to represent their total constituencies as they do, but to become feminists. And many of them just become feminists when they get to the Congress. We like to see women and men running with as feminists to begin with. And that's why the National Women's Political Caucus was originally formed, to try to encourage a whole program and platform that would encourage that. But in the meantime, we need to have a lot more women. We only have 22 out of 435 in the House, 2 out of 100 in the Senate. It's true we've doubled the numbers in the state legislatures to 13%, but it's still not at all commensurate with where we are. It seems kind of nuts, actually, when you think about it. We've done everything in pairs since Noah except govern, and I think it's overdue.
When you helped found the National Women's Political Caucus, you said that you didn't want to replace the male white middle class leadership with female white middle class elite. Do you think that that's happened? Do you think that the...
Well, I think that's been the posture. I mean, we were opposed to discrimination based on sex, but we're also opposed to racism. We're opposed to poverty. We're opposed to institutional violence at home and abroad. Those were the broad outlines of the basis for the formation of the caucus. We dealt with all issues affecting minority women, as well as elderly women, as well as women of different sexual preference and so on. We felt issues of war and peace were very effectively the concern of women. We tried to broaden the vista as to what it is that... we wanted to accomplish. There's no point in just electing women, qua women. We want women because we feel that they bring a different dimension into politics, that they will bring a certain socialization and acculturation, that they add a dimension of compassion and vulnerability from their life's experience as well as from their community experience, and that they bring with them a certain independence and insurgency that is crucial, I think. And we want them to change the nature of power. We want to change the nature of power. We don't want, obviously, we've got power which has created priorities that aren't suitable. Essentially, in the gender gap, that's what it's all about. Women are not content with the priorities, and they're voting differently and thinking differently because of that. So what we're trying to do is to change the nature of power. I mean, that's what the movement is trying to do, but interestingly enough, individual women are thinking that way and voting that way, whether they consider themselves part of a movement or not, in the gender gap.
Have you been in the position of deciding between a liberal male candidate and a more conservative female candidate, deciding which you were going to back?
Well, I have certain requirements in terms of whom I support. And, if a male and a female have the same positions, because I think it's desperate that we get more women into policymaking, so we get some more common sense and some more objectivity into it, that I would vote for a woman. But I don't vote for women who don't support the views that I think are important. In other words, I'm going to vote for a woman who opposes, who's for big military spending at the sacrifice of social programs. I'm going to vote for a woman who opposes the right to reproductive freedom. I'm not going to vote for that kind of woman. Why should I? I'm trying to change power. I'm not trying to perpetuate backwardness.
Are there women's issues that you think should be but have not yet been accepted in the political agenda of the Democratic Party?
I think that they're open to a lot of suggestions on programmatic changes. I mean, we've been through a long struggle on that. I mean, we've been working since the formation of the caucus and other women's groups with bringing impact into the conventions on program. We fought very hard in 72 to have a total women's plank, which was historic. We've improved that each year, added to it. And we can get a lot of programmatic response. Our big problem is that we're not getting enough political support to open up the power structure to women. And that has to become a much more militant request on the part of political activists in the Democratic Party, men and women, women in the women's movement. We have to accelerate our demand. I mean, it's just shocking that with a woman being 53% of the electorate, that we have so few women making decisions. They haven't been great decisions. So certainly we couldn't hurt. We could only help. I think that we would help. So, I mean, our big problem is that we've been much too timid. As I say in the book, women have traditionally been trained to speak softly, that is some of us, and to carry a lipstick. And that's not good enough. We got to do a lot more. And now our demand has got to accelerate, not only for the sake of women and their economic equity. I mean, women are still making 59 to 62 cents on the dollar compared to men, and they are a majority of the workforce, and homemakers are struggling to get by. I mean, elderly women are living on half the income of elderly men. Poor women have been a major victim of the Reagan administration with the budget cuts for themselves and their children. 40% of the cuts are women and children who have been cut out of the budget. Working women, I've described, displaced homemakers don't have job training programs. We've got a feminization of poverty coming abroad. I'm sure you've heard about that, so that a majority of women and children will be in poverty and by the year 2000. Women care deeply about whether this society is going to survive at all, issues of war and peace. Men do too, but women seem to care more deeply historically always. And I think that we have to go forward.
In party politics, there's always...
And the only way I think we can go forward is by saying, look, if you're really serious about equality, then you ought to make it your business to say that you're going to give open seats to women and support them from the beginning. The trouble we have in politics is that we can't get our party support from the beginning. If we did, most of us who ran for the Senate, and we described that very fully in the book in a chapter called Miss Super Candidate, would be in the Senate. Instead, they often run candidates against us.
Give us an example.
Well, I was a front runner in my campaign. There was Moynihan. No, before Moynihan, there was O'Dwyer and Ramsey Clark. I mean, I was way ahead. And the party decided they had to get somebody else other than me. I was obviously going to be the winner. They brought in Moynihan at the last minute, and they gave him the support. And then they kept these other two men in by giving them votes at the Democratic Convention so they could split my liberal vote. I won all the conservative and rural votes in my state. And it was my liberal vote in New York City. It was split by these two guys who didn't have a chance. And when Harriet Woods ran in Missouri recently for the United States Senate, she didn't get the party support soon enough. She could easily have won, and she lost by a very small percentage. When Patsy Mink ran in Hawaii, a wonderful congresswoman served with, they supported a male who had been in the Congress against her. When Elizabeth Holzman ran, she got what I would call was tepid party support. This is unforgivable. Obviously, those who control the United States Senate don't want to open it up to women, because once we get in there, obviously there'll be others. I think it's important to understand that women make a difference. We tend to be more independent, not coming from the boardrooms and the back rooms, but from the communities of concern. And there's a lot of leeriness about it and uncertainty about it. And we have to work a lot harder. Men and women in the public support women for public office in the 80 percentiles on high levels, including president and vice president. But it's the structures that sort of don't give you the support you need to begin with.
It's, I suppose, one of the reasons why you're so interested in registering more women and organizing the women's vote.
Well, I think that women's vote makes a difference. In 1980, 8% fewer women than men voted for Mr. Reagan. They already suspected what was to come. Exit polls showed that ABC, NBC, CBS polls, that women felt that he would get us into war. That he was also anti-ERA, which was a shock to the whole country because he was the first president in seven presidents, Republican and Democrat, who didn't support it. And he reversed a 40-year history of support of the Equal Rights Amendment of the Republican Party. And that was shown in the exit polls as to why people voted against them. Women. 6 million more women than men voted. In 1980 to 82, opinion polls continued to show that women were much more disapproving of Mr. Reagan's foreign policies, economic policies, not only the discrimination against them and his opposition to equal rights, but his post-social budget cuts. And they also were very much more opposed to him because of his attack upon reproductive freedom, where he uses his White House as a pulpit to attack the rights of the women and the born, and while he's seeking rights for the unborn. Yes, and so in 1981, Women USA commenced upon, and in 82, developed a project to prove that there was a gender gap which would be consistent and that it could be mobilized and organized. We conducted a six-day pilot project in Texas and Missouri and Iowa and Oregon and California. And we discovered in Ohio that, in fact, women voted issues, that they voted for economic issues, and particularly for candidates on the basis of whether they understood the fact that women felt very discriminated against economically, and that also they voted for peace, and they voted for, obviously, equal rights, and that that was across a lot of lines, both Democrats and Republicans, independents, as well as homemakers and working people. Now, it turned out that in 82, the gender gap continued. And what had been a matter of astonishment to many pollsters and pundits seemed to now have become part of the political landscape. And they voted for at least three governors because they were good on those issues. And they were responsible for electing the governors of Texas, Michigan, and New York in the sense that their margin of victory was based upon their extra votes from women. And so was the case with some members of Congress. And they continue now in the opinion polls to show much more disapproval of Mr. Reagan. And my projection in this book is that in 1984, 9 million more women than men will vote, 6 million more women than men voted in 1980, and that almost upwards of 58 to 60 million women should vote. And though many people will be voting to defeat Mr. Reagan, women will provide by a gender gap the margin of defeat, as well as I think they will do with many members of Congress, people in the state houses and the city halls, too.
Bella Abzug is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, The Gender Gap. What are you doing in Women USA to get women to identify themselves with a voting bloc of women?
Well, we're a nonpartisan organization, and what we do is go out and hire indigenous organizers in different states and put together coalitions. We're not a membership organization through which other organizations who have multi-agendas, we have just this agenda, can identify the issues that women care about in those areas, make them public, and then help to register and then help to turn out those votes. We're also part of a National Women's Vote Coalition, which encompasses about 65 organizations, which are very generalized women's groups of one kind or another, but many of whom are becoming more actively involved in registering their own members than others. So there's a lot of activity going on because, as we project in this book, we'd like to see another 2 million more women at least registered. We think that can make a difference in the elections.
How do you think you can see now the effect of women organizing in the vote, influencing the platforms of the candidates that are running now?
Well, the way that's done is very simple. I'll give you an example. In our original pilot study in Ohio and California, we did surveys which were constructed, pre-election surveys, to ascertain in those areas where how women felt. We then made public the results of those surveys at big press conferences involving 20, 30, 40 women's organizations. That had an immediate impact upon the candidates in those areas. When they know, if they haven't already found out what the issues are that women care about, which are peace, economic justice, and equality, and that they're going to vote for candidates on issues. I mean, if you know, 60% of the Democratic Party are women now, and it's true that the Democratic Party has been the beneficiary of the gender gap because they so disapprove of Mr. Reagan and his policies. But it's not owned by the Democratic Party. If a candidate is a big war hawk or a big military spender, or if he's attacking social programs or attacking, you know, the rights of reproductive freedom and so on, he's not going to get the support of women. So it's really issues. Women are not voting party label or good looks as much as they are issues. Women's lives have changed, and they have a much more impelling urgency upon the power structures and institutions to respond to them. It's not happening, and that's why you see a gender gap. Some come at it from economic points of view, others from the peace point of view, others from just feeling terribly vulnerable, others feeling concern and agony about what's going to happen to their kids in a society that's in a collision course for nuclear war. But whatever it is, it's saying, you know, things have got to change.
You've made clear your opinions of President Reagan's stand on women's issues. How do you rate the current Democratic primary candidates?
Well, they're all very good on women's issues, and that's not an accident. I mean, some people may think it's an accident, but it's not. I mean, there's been a big, strong women's movement that's been putting a lot of pressure for a long time, in addition to which we put together a presidential project, which consists of most of the leaders of the political, of the women's movement, as well as active members of Congress and state legislatures and members of the Democratic National Committee, which propounded many serious questions to all of the presidential candidates as they got into the primary, and to continue to not only get answers, but also had them appear before conventions of women's groups, which continue to press their issues. So these candidates are pretty strong on women's issues. Senator Mondale has a long history from the time he was a senator in child care and women's equity, in health programs and education programs. He's a leader in those fights at an early time. Gary Hart obviously has tried to stress a lot of women's issues initially in his campaign. Somewhere along the line when he came to prominence, I think he did less of it. But nevertheless, he did have a very effective staff of women and so on. And Jesse Jackson has tried to also relate to some of the issues that women care about. So, I mean, they've all been into it. There's no question about that. And it's a result of the impact and pressure placed upon it by a strengthened women's movement and by the gender gap response on the part of women themselves, regardless of whether they identify as feminists or part of a women's movement. Really, millions of women are really part of a women's movement because millions of women identify with the problems that they have and with the priorities that they like to change. And that's what their votes are saying, and that's what they're saying as they're being measured in the opinion polls.
When Jimmy Carter first ran for president, he promised that he would fight on behalf of the Equal Rights Amendment, and he did get the backing of national women's groups. I know that you were disappointed in the amount of muscle he actually used for the ERA once elected. How can you tell on a campaign whether somebody's really going to go to bat for women's issues or whether they're just giving lip service to it during the campaign?
You can't. But you have to keep a pressure on. What we tried to do, I mean, I worked very hard for the election of Jimmy Carter, and I helped to resolve his differences with the women at the Democratic Convention and got a whole series of commitments, many of whom he kept, by the way, not only with respect to the ERA, but also with respect to appointments and judges and people, women on high level and so on. Many people felt he could have done more by using his power as president to get the Equal Rights Amendment. Also, we were very deeply concerned, since he did say he wanted to be the president that did for equal rights what Lyndon Johnson did for civil rights, when, in facing re-election, he began to cut the social programs affecting women and to increase the military, which we thought was a move away from women's concerns. Sometimes people narrowly interpret your concerns as being the traditional issues of just equal rights and abortion, which is a mistake. As you know, we issued a report in this women's commission that I was a co-chair of. And he fired me because he thought that would help him, I suppose, or anyhow. He disagreed that we should criticize these big adult questions of budget and military and priorities and so on, rather than staying to just the traditional issues. Martin Abzug always said it took a Bella Abzug to get fired from an unpaid job. However, I was used as a scapegoat and the majority of the committee resigned, and we were all very saddened by it. And I was especially saddened by it. What we try to do all the time is keep the feet to the fire. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Our report was an effort to keep his feet to the fire. And obviously he didn't like it. I guess we learn from those experiences and we continue to go on as we get stronger and bigger. And as the votes come out more and more strong, it'll be very difficult to make promises and not carry them out. I believe that this period is going to show that women are going to ultimately develop that kind of clout, which will enable them to elect, as I said before in this book, not only the next president of the United States, but who's going to be in the Congress and in the state legislatures. And when we are able to show that, I think women will be taken much more seriously instead of treated like some chicken feed or peanut lobbyists, which we're not. We're a majority of the public. We're not a special interest. We are really, an important signpost as to whether or not we're making any progress in this society or not.
There's been some speculation that the Democratic candidate who wins the party's nomination might choose a woman as a running mate. Do you think there's any chance for that?
Well, we've raised that issue. That's come directly out of the women's movement. It came out of the Presidential Project and out of various organizations. I think our chances are 60-40. I think as the thing becomes talked about more, debated in the media, thought about by political candidates, questioned and so on, that it becomes more of a reality. As I said earlier, 80% of the public says that they would support a presidential candidate or a vice presidential candidate, as well as members of the Senate and governors and so on, who are women. But they don't face the reality until they have to judge it. Now there's some thinking about it going on in the public mind. There's some pressure for it. Some say that it's a wash between the way men feel and the way women feel as to whether it would make a difference on the ticket. Personally, I interpret the polls as meaning that it is a plus. And some of the polls that I have seen have shown that a woman on a ticket would increase that ticket's chance by about 10%. It's interesting that even the poll which says it's a wash, a CBS Times poll, shows that women feel very strongly about it, so that let's say 10 to 12% more Republican women would vote Democratic if there's a woman on the Democratic ticket. And moderate women would vote in similar percentages and so on for that ticket. And it's an interesting point. It's only logical. You talk about balance when you choose a vice presidential candidate. What better balance is there than having a woman? And having that woman articulate the key issues of peace, economic justice, and equality, which have got to be much more seriously emphasized. I mean, we're in a real deep trouble in this country.
What do you think of the obstacles standing in the way now to a woman running for vice president?
Continued bias on the part of those who control the power structure, fear of opening up the sharing power, uncertainty that there's too much prejudice in the land, who are not accustomed to seeing women in the palaces of power, and just poor judgment.
I know that you have met women in politics and out of it who are not feminists and who even oppose issues like the ERA. Do you have any ideas why women would be opposed to equal rights for women?
You're talking about women in politics or women in general?
Let's start with women in politics and then go to women in general.
Well, let me tell you, there's been an increasing sensitivity on the part of women in politics to women's issues. It was very often the case initially when I came to politics that women who were in politics would say, oh, no, I'm not a feminist, as if there was something wrong with it. And you know, feminism is really just a description of the legal struggle for legal and economic and political and cultural equality for women. It's really not a threatening thing if you understand what it is. And it therefore really touches every human being, both women and men in this country. For me, actually, feminism is a vision of what I love and what I love to see, what kind of society which is free of discrimination based on sex or age or handicap or sexual preference or race or religion or ethnicity, a society that in which people live together in harmony and peace and beauty and environment and enjoy it. It's a humanist notion. And I think that that's so for many. But the interesting thing is that because it exploded on the American scene in the early 70s, late 60s, it was a truly very strong statement, and people misinterpreted it, and they developed all kinds of notions about what women wanted. There was all this talk about bra burning, etc. I've been in the movement from its beginnings. I've never saw a bra burned, nor have I ever seen a man exorcised. The point is that now political women see it almost as a necessity for them. They're not afraid to say that they're feminists. They understand that it's the full range of needs for women, economic, political, cultural, social. Many women come to Congress, find out about it, find out how the laws really do exclude women, and are shocked by it. And they then tell you that they became feminists and that they now have to speak for women. This is Democratic and Republican women. So that's increasingly a very important statement on the part of political women. There are still some women who oppose it. I remember jokingly that when Lenore Sullivan, who was a very powerful woman in the Congress, one of the four in the history of Congress that ever chaired a major committee, four There have only been 116 out of 10,957 members of Congress who are women, but only four ever were chair of major committees. She said, I don't need the Equal Rights Amendment because I'm more than equal. It reminds me of a poster I saw, a bumper sticker that said, women who seek equality with men lack ambition. Think about that. It's a funny statement. Anyhow, you don't seem to be laughing.
That's no, why. I get it.
So anyhow, but basically, most women are for it. For example, there was a test of that. Almost everyone except one woman, I think, in the Congress again voted for the Equal Rights Amendment in its last failure. And the same thing took place when we were in the Congress. Just a couple of women. One woman didn't vote for it. So there's a strong understanding among political women of feminism, whether they want to call themselves that or not, but more and more are. And more of them are working in those directions. Why are some people afraid? Because they still don't understand what it means. Of course, some people are threatened by change. I mean, just like when we went to get the vote in this country, there were some women who said they'd never, never vote. It was a sin to vote. It would destroy the moral fiber of our society if they voted. Those women are all voting when they got the vote. Same thing's going to happen here. We're going to get equal rights into the Constitution for everybody. So those who have a need will avail themselves of it, even some of its strongest opponents. There are always agents who oppose social change of any kind. And to some, I think it's genuinely threatening. The idea of independence, equality, which sort of goes with it, does threaten somebody that's been totally dependent all of her life, and she's not too sure what's going to come of it and what she has to do as a result. So, I mean, those things are understandable, and I understand it.
Do you think women legislators have access to all the channels of power that men do? And I guess what I'm asking is, are there certain, like, bars that mostly men hang out in, or even information that's discussed in the men's room, which is an old cliche, that women wouldn't really be in on?
Yeah. We're not in the old boys' club. We don't play paddle ball instead of coming to vote in the Congress of the United States, as a lot of these people do. We don't run around whoring and drinking. I mean, it's just a sort of a allegorical statement. But what I mean is basically women seem less corruptible at this point. And they seem less involved in this sort of the status symbols that a lot of politicians or men in a lot of professions are engaged in to prove their masculinity and their prowess. Women are not into that. That's not the way we were brought up. And I guess I don't think we'll ever quite run our lives that way. It's just not, we don't have to prove anything. So we're not into the old boys network. We are learning about power, and we know something about power, and we know how to negotiate, and we know how to make our necessary arrangements in order to get pieces of legislation that we want passed and so on. But we're basically not in too much control of power. Women essentially are outside of the power structures within the power structure.
What did you try to do when you were in Congress to try to break into it?
I never tried to break into it. I simply tried to show by my competence, by my hard working, my ability, that I was a good legislator and that I was a creative and innovative person who could be counted upon to do a good job. That came to be very important, and people came to respect it. At first, they thought I was sort of a most unusual, to put the word mildly, in that I was extremely outspoken about how I felt about everything. I mean, I was among the first to call for Mr. Nixon's impeachment. It took a full year after that before the Judiciary Committee really ever got underway to examine impeachment. I was very adamant about the war in Vietnam and continued to talk very heavily against it and organize and so on. And ultimately, they came to agree with me. I spent a lot of time developing techniques with the rules and uncovered new rules that had not been used for many years, such as the resolution of inquiry, which would help bring the government to the Congress within 5 days to explain why certain policies were not certain facts that you were allowed to get before the Congress, which had through which I got the Pentagon Papers before the Congress, I used my ability and my skill to show that I had to be listened to, as well as my persistence.
Do you think you'll run again for office?
I think as a political person, running for office is my most viable political option. And I think about it all the time. And I'm hoping that I have to find the right time and place.
What would be the right office?
Right now, people are trying to get me to run for Congress. I haven't made up my mind about that.
I forget what year it was, but you co-founded the Women's Strike for Peace. And the role in national politics for women has changed a lot since then. What do you think that women's role as an activist force was then compared to now? Can you draw a comparison?
Well, I mean, all that happened. Well, you mean in politics?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I ran, that was in 1961. I don't even know how many women there were in the Congress then. When I ran in 71.
I mean, in the political process. I don't mean in office.
Well, there were periods where, for example, in the Democratic Party under Roosevelt, there was a lot of activity by women. Eleanor Roosevelt had a lot to do with it. And some of her friends in the Democratic Party got a lot accomplished. She, as a matter of fact, always talked about 50-50, which is what we ultimately accomplished, called equal division of women representation at the delegates to the convention. We had the Secretary of Labor Perkins, who were active and important. After that, there were not that many women who were active in the process that had much impact. We describe a lot of that in the book and its history. We regarded ourselves as supplicants rather than as participants, begging, pleading, pressuring, hoping. And in the 70s, we got a little further than that. We started to do some negotiating and some demanding. But it was still a lot of negotiating and still from the outside. And I think we've now come to realize that none of that's good enough, that we have to be inside, that we've done a lot of begging and pleading and hoping and praying, and that hasn't worked. And that now we've got to develop the political clout to make the difference of our own in our own lives and the lives of those we care about. And that's what I think is happening. I think you're going to see a developing political clout out of it. It's not quite a formal bloc, but it's like a bloc of power. And when that happens, then women will have a role that is really constructive, not only in terms of direct relationship to the power structure and the people they elect, but electing more women, and also in the coalitions in which women work. They still don't have the kind of respect that their clout really entitles them to. And that's going to be crucial in the next period, especially in the 84 election. And I hope this is just the beginning. It's not the end. I mean, we can't judge what happens in 84 as the end. I think it's just the beginning of a peaking of women realizing that they now have to become a major political movement in this country, a major political voice, which is very different from any kind of political voice before. It's the major moral movement of our time, in my opinion. Minorities are doing an enormous amount at this moment, and that's like a reassertion of an attempt since the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Movement to say we're down at the bottom, but we're not going to stay there. And women are really saying a very much a lot more of that nature, but they're beginning to demand a lot more, and they must.
Bill Abzug, I want to thank you for talking with us, and there's one more quick question I want to ask you, and you probably thought I wasn't going to ask you about this, but I notice you are wearing a hat today. How did that become a trademark for you?
Well, this goes back to when I was a young lawyer, and they thought I was the secretary or the clerk, and they would always say, we're waiting for the lawyer, whenever I came to do business with lawyers or with a client of my law firm. And so at that time, professional women wore hats. They also wore gloves. And so I went home and talked to Martin, my husband, about it, and I put on a hat and gloves, but I've since taken off the gloves, you've probably noticed. I continued to wear a hat. When I walked down the street with campaign workers in my first campaign, people would say, come meet Bella Abzug. And they'd say, oh, she's the one with the hat. And they'd say, which one is she? And they'd say, oh, she's the one with the hat on. And so people thought that it was a campaign gimmick, but it was just that I had grown to like wearing hats, and I continued to wear them. When I came to Congress, they made a big fuss about it. I didn't know whether they wanted me to take it off or keep it on. In any case, I kept it on. Sometimes I don't wear it, though.
Okay. Thanks a lot for talking with us. My guest has been Bella Abzug, former congresswoman, and she's a lawyer, organizer, and author of the new book, Gender Gap, co-authored with Mim Kelber. And Gender Gap has been published in paperback by Houghton Mifflin.